The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. I am very excited to welcome our guests this evening. Stacey Abrams is the best-selling author of Lead from the Outside, a serial entrepreneur, nonprofit CEO, and political leader. After serving 11 years in the Georgia House of Representatives, 7 as minority leader, Abrams became the 2018 Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia, where she won more votes than any other Democrat in the state's history. Over the course of her career, she has founded multiple organizations devoted to voting rights, training and hiring young people of color, and tackling social issues at both the state and national levels. Dedicated to civic engagement, her most recent endeavors include launching Fair Fight to ensure every American has a voice in our election system, Fair Count to ensure accuracy in the 2020 census and greater participation in civic engagement, and the Southern Economic Advancement Project, a public policy initiative to broaden economic power and build equity in the South. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with Tamela Edwards, anchor of 6 ABC Action News Morning Edition, and a crowd favorite here at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Tamela, over to you.
All right, Andy, thank you. It always is an honor to participate. Stacey, it is also an incredible honor to get to spend some time with you this evening. And what a week to be here with you. We are a week out after the Georgia primary. And I mean, the phrase hot mess seems as though it could have been coined to go with this primary. But it also seems to be a story in two parts. And I wondered how you were looking at it. On one hand, we had an absolute breakdown. Long lines, broken machines, people being told that their ballots weren't there, everything that could go wrong, understaffing, went wrong. Still, the counting is going on. But then I looked at some of these numbers. When you ran for governor 2 years ago in the Democratic primary, 550,000 people came out around this time to vote. This last week, over 1 million people, double those numbers, came out in the Democratic primary. That's actually more than came out in the hot contest between Clinton and Obama back in 2008. It tells you something about the hunger and about the desire. So do you find yourself looking at the mess or looking at, oh my goodness, how many people came out?
Yes. I mean, okay. That's actually one of the most important pieces that I try to address in Our Time Is Now, which is that there is an inverse relationship, some would imagine, between voter suppression and voter participation. That if suppression exists, participation necessarily goes down. It's actually not what happens. When people are aware of the inequities, when they are aware of an attempt to stop them from being heard, when they think about it not as a reason to feel defeated, but as a reason to feel energized, the concomitant effect is that you do indeed see voter participation go up. And so in the midst of the 2020 election, with a Secretary of State who showed a deliberate indifference to voters, who has taken no responsibility for what has been referred to as a complete disaster, complete mess. You think of the term of art it has been used to apply, and it's been said by both Democrats and Republicans who have said that this was a total debacle. You see that he did his best to not only demonstrate his malfeasance by maintaining some of the systems that have harmed voters for decades, but he also showed his incompetence and his inability to just run a basic election. But at the same time, the energy that we've seen in these demonstrations, the concerns that have surrounded COVID, because we can't ignore that COVID-19 has had a disproportionate effect on Georgia. The city of Albany, nearby where you grew up, where you were born, Albany at one point was the fourth highest incident rate of infection in the world. Yeah. So COVID continues to ravage Georgia. Even though the governor pretends that everything's fine, we just have it spiked again, but we have a steady hum of infection. You have that plus the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, the murder of Rayshard Brooks. And what we see is an energized community, especially a Black community that votes pretty much 90 to 95% Democratic, showing up along with others and saying we will be heard and we will demand change.
I want to get into actually a couple of different things that you raised. There's an old saying, never let a good catastrophe go to waste. Is this past week actually a good thing? Is there a degree to which he might be shamed, where there might be legal action, where there might be something that happens because things went so poorly? Or no, those same people, their only recourse will be prepare to take the first Tuesday in November off and stay there all day if you have to.
Well, we would point out that what happened on Tuesday is just an expanded version of what happened in 2018, that what we saw play out there did lead to litigation. It has led to a couple of legal settlements, but it has not been sufficient to solve the problem. When I was writing Our Time Is Now, it was written in the aftermath of that election. But my approach was, rather than bemoan my lack of election, I wanted to focus on the infrastructure that was broken by his predecessor, Brian Kemp, that he agreed to maintain when he ran for the office, that he exposed when he attempted to purge more than 300,000 people in December of 2019. We know that what happened in 18 repeated itself on Tuesday. Only the worst part of it is, what we know is that when you break democracy, even if you are targeting communities of color, even if you're targeting the poor or young people, it breaks for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part of this catastrophe that is resonating the most, because folks who thought they were immune to the voter suppression that they doubted could exist, they were the same folks who didn't get their absentee ballots in the mail. They were the same people who were trapped in hours-long lines. They're the same folks in really wealthy counties and very poor counties who had to have courts extend the time of the election, because fundamentally, our election system in Georgia is broken, and this is not the only state where this happens. We just have to be of such large size and certainly of such cataclysmic effect that people are paying attention, but we can't ignore that it happens around the country.
So then what comes out of that? Like you had noted, I mean, we know that Republicans in particular are worried about white suburban women, many of the kinds of people that you're talking about who did not get their ballots and are saying, what the heck is this? What does that mean? Do they now go into some rooms and make some differences? Does the Republican Party get worried? Or do you think they're willing to let that ride to get what they want?
Georgia had not only a record-setting election with Democrats outperforming our 2008 numbers, we outperformed Republicans. And that does not happen, or has not happened recently, in primaries in Georgia. Just today, a very competitive district, District 7, which had competitive primaries on both sides of the aisle, our Democratic candidate vastly outperformed the Republicans who voted on the other side, which is a signal that says that Georgia is a deeply competitive state. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that Republicans can't afford to leave any vote untouched. They can't afford to break the machinery in suburban counties, because in Georgia, suburban counties mean Black and white and Latino and Asian Pacific Islander. They can't cordon off communities and say, well, you can go and vote and you can't, because we are a state of more than almost 11 million people. And the intersections of our lives and the intersections of our neighborhoods, the intersections of our interest, mean that if you try to target communities of color when we're this narrowly competitive, you are not going to win. And so they are going to have to take action. In fact, the Speaker of the House announced an investigation. He rightly said that it's inappropriate for the Secretary of State to investigate himself or the counties that are being touted as the problem counties. He recognized that those two counties may be two of the counties that had challenges, but so did the counties where he represents folks in Georgia. And so he recognized that this is going to have to be a broader conversation. But what's fundamental is this: elections have consequences, but they also have people who are responsible for being the arbiters of success. And when your Secretary of State shows a deliberate indifference for voters, when he is willing to spend $400,000 touting his purchase of $100 million worth of machines that don't all work, rather than investing those very monies in actually hiring people to make elections work, then we have a problem. And this catastrophe has shown that Democrats and Republicans, if we want our democracy to work in Georgia, we have to work to make certain that we hold the Secretary of State accountable.
I want to go back into some of the history here, that there was some limits on the machines or some limits on what people were willing to do when there were things like pre-clearance, other things you had to do to talk about how you would be voting. And once that all went away, it seemed as though everything was up in the air. And I, as I talk to people, they may know more in Georgia because they're living through it. The number of people who really don't understand why that Voting Rights Act mattered, why pre-clearance mattered, what the effect was. There are probably some people on this chat right now, on this author event, and I wanted you to walk them through how we got here. Because honestly, Stacey, there are times when I think, I might as well be standing in my grandmother's shoes. This sounds like stories she used to tell.
In fact, that's one of the reasons for the book. I was having two conversations. I had a conversation with my grandmother when I was in the midst of our campaign, and she told me about how difficult it was to screw up her courage to vote in 1968 because of her lived experience with voter suppression, with Jim Crow, with the dehumanization of her as a citizen, with this diminution of her rights. Even when they were exposed and when the Voting Rights Act said, yes, you can, she thought, no, I shouldn't. But I also had a conversation with a young woman who traveled the state with me. She was my body person. She helped me throughout the campaign. And we were having a conversation about poll taxes. We were looking at what happened in Florida and the fact that Floridians in 2018 voted by 65% to restore the right to vote to former offenders, to returning citizens. And we were talking about the phrase poll tax, and she sort of rejected it. And she said, isn't there a better way to describe it? And I said, no, poll taxes are, that's what it literally was. You had to pay a tax to vote at a polling place. And the disconnect that she felt from that language really raised for me the awareness of how little we understand in the 21st century what was a long fought battle that was only partially won in 65. And I frame it in that way to say this. The reason I spend the first half of the book walking through the legacy of voter suppression is, one, we have to know this is not new. It was built into our democracy. The Declaration of Independence was this lofty notion, but the minute we wrote our organizing documents, we wrote the Constitution, it excluded African Americans as non-human. It said women should be invisible. It said that Native Americans had no rights at all. And we saw from that time forward, even white men were denied the right to vote unless they owned land. Only 6% of Americans at the time of our creation were actually included in the exercise of our democracy. And so every single generation, every single iteration of progress has been built on the original fundamental challenge of voter suppression. When we get to 1965, that's in the wake of the 15th Amendment that gave blacks the right to vote, that gave black men the right to vote, the 19th Amendment, which gave white women the right to vote, the 26th Amendment, which gave 18-year-olds the right to vote, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was the only law that actually gave black women and other women of color the right to vote in our country. When you look at that scope, part of what the Voting Rights Act did was say that in each of these constitutional amendments, what was missing was the imprimatur to make it real. Yes, it said you could, but there was nothing to say that the states, which had been given the constitutional authority to administer elections, there was nothing to say, yes, they had to. And so what the Voting Rights Act did with two sections, Section 4 and Section 5, which are tend to be read together, said pre-clearance. You have to ask permission before you change any laws that help diminish the ability of people to access the right to vote, particularly communities of color. And that governed the 9 former states of the Confederacy, but it also pulled in different states and different communities over time, such as the state of Arizona, which had a long history of discriminating against Latinos and Native Americans, parts of California, parts of Wisconsin. And so different communities were pulled into the Voting Rights Act under its penumbra. But the second part, which we don't talk about as often, and I actually don't address very closely in the book because it's only recently come under attack, is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which said you can pass no laws that have the effect of prescribing the ability of people to vote because of race or language. These two pieces are the only pieces that kept states in check, states that did not want to join America in its fulfillment of its promise that everyone was equal and everyone should have access. Those states were only held in check because of the Voting Rights Act. And when the Supreme Court eviscerated Section 5, it opened the floodgates for not only the return of things that your grandmother saw, but it allowed for this labyrinth of rules that no longer had the racial intention or the racial directness that Jim Crow did. Jim Crow said, you can't vote because you're Black. Instead, what we have is restrictive ID that makes it harder to get if you are Black. You no longer have poll taxes that say you must pay this tax in order to be able to cast your ballot. Instead, we have 8-hour lines that cost you an entire day's wage in order to cast your ballot, because in most states, you don't get paid time off to vote. And so what we have to do is take this history of what we know worked as voter suppression and translate it into the modern equivalent. And that's what I try to lay out in fairly gripping detail in this book.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you laid out, because the other side will try to say, well, this makes perfect sense. If you will get a license to drive a car, if you need a license to enter a building, what's so hard about getting the proper information that you need to get your voter ID? They're very big on voter ID. What's so hard about, they make it seem as though it makes perfect sense. So let's start with that one and why it actually is a bit tricky.
Well, that's both the seductive nature of voter suppression, but also why it's so insidious, because it looks like logic. It looks like administrative requirements, but it also makes the inability to traverse them. It makes it look like user error, that I wasn't smart enough, that I didn't try hard enough, that it was my fault. But let's start with voter ID. Every state in the country has always had some requirement for identification. This is not new. What became novel around 20 years ago, when voter ID reared its head again and became more restrictive, was this notion that yes, you could use ID, but we're going to limit the forms of ID that you're allowed to use. So here are a few examples. If you live in Texas, you can register to vote and you can show up at the polling place and show your gun license. But if you show up with your student ID, that even if it's issued by the same state that issues your gun license, the same state to which you pay your taxes, and in fact, if you're a student, the state to which you pay your tuition, your ID, your student ID does not count. It cannot be used as identification. In the state of Wisconsin, a 100-year-old woman who'd been able to vote in election after election in that state, in 2015, Wisconsin created more restrictions on their voter ID. So she'd been able to show her license, go and vote, no challenge. In 2015, they said, well, to update your license so you can vote this time, you've got to give us your original birth certificate. She was born during segregation. And if you were born basically before 1964, 1965, you were likely born not only in segregation, but you were not allowed to be born in a white hospital, which means you were not issued a birth certificate. And so there are thousands of Americans, hundreds of thousands, who do not have access to that original document. And because of that, because of her inability to go back in time and erase Jim Crow in 2016, she was denied the right to vote. Not because she could not prove who she was. She could show them a copy of the census in 1930 that had her name in it. But because she didn't have a photo ID that complied with a newly lengthened set of documentation, she was not permitted to vote. And so across this country, we have seen direct and very deliberate attempts to narrow who can use ID and what those IDs can be. So it's deeply disingenuous when folks say, oh, you have to have an ID to buy, you know, to buy beer. The reality is the constitutional right to vote should not be precluded because you have to sit on a phone for 7 to 8 hours trying to get someone to tell you how you can get copies of a document that you may or may not have access to. For women, for example, who've gotten married, there are states that added requirements that say that you have to be able to provide certain numbers of additional proof. That means you've got to spend time and money tracking down these documents that aren't required for your Social Security card, aren't required for your driver's license generally, aren't required to get your cough medicine. But for you to be able to vote, they've added these new restrictions that make it harder. And because of that, it is more difficult for women, people of color, and poor people who can't afford to pay for those additional documents to be able to participate in the only process that will actually lift them up and allow them to have access to the services and the supports they need.
What do you think will ultimately be the answer here? Will it be a voter drive where you say, okay, we're going to get out here and help everybody get what they need, get them registered, get these documents? Is it to push for there to be a national law that says these are the documents and the only documents that everybody has? Because state is voting technically is a state function. Where do you see the end game being on dealing with voter suppression?
So let's push back on that. The administration of elections has been delegated to the states, but there is a constitutional right to vote.
True.
And that federal constitutional right should not be impinged upon because states decide to make it more complicated to execute. And that is why we have a federal government, to say that here are the floors we have to set below which no one should be denied. So there can be ceilings set for what we can have, but there should be a floor that's set that says no state should be able to create more hazards below this level. And so, yes, there should be standards for what ID looks like. But the reality is there are some states that have very, very easily run their elections for years without requiring certain forms of photo identification. That's fine with me. And let's be clear, it's not just photos. In the state of North Dakota, they required in 2018, they required that North Dakota Native Americans, basically the state, required that you had to have residential addresses on your driver's license in order to cast a ballot. Okay? Sounds normal. Everyone says, oh, that's logical. The problem is if you live on a reservation, under the terms and conditions across most Native American reservations, they are not assigned residential addresses. They do not receive access to the traditional postal services that those of us who live in urban and suburban areas are used to. They do not have access. And in fact, it was a known issue in North Dakota because those very same Native Americans were the ones who in 2012 helped boost Heidi Heitkamp and make her the U.S. Senator. And so this rule was specifically designed to say that if you didn't have this thing that de minimis seems logical to someone like me who's always lived in the city, but if you're Native American, that was a license for the state to take away your ability to vote. And it worked. Thousands of Native Americans were denied the right to vote. And the Supreme Court said, well, most people in North Dakota can meet the standard, so the standard's okay. So the reality is we have to say that there can be no legitimate impositions on people that restrict their ability to vote if they can provide genuine proof of who they are. And we know that there is not a rash of people running around pretending to be someone else. Even the Heritage Foundation, which prides itself on its very careful accumulation of voter fraud, can only find 1,300 examples in the last 20 years out of more than 625 million votes cast.
Were you made hopeful this week by the Supreme Court ruling on LGBTQ rights, that as these cases may make their way to the high court, that you might be surprised in how the court might rule and what has to be done or not done?
No, I was pleased by their decision, but I've watched this happen before. In the same year we got the Obergefell decision, they giveth with one hand and take away with the other, because in the same year that they made this decision that truly, I think, embodied the intent of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, this is the same court that just 2 months ago told Black folks in Milwaukee that it was okay to force them to go and vote at the height of COVID-19, that sent millions of Wisconsinites out into the cold, out into danger, and refused to grant them the ability to vote from home and to have those votes counted without risking their lives. And so, no, I don't take a great deal of comfort from this moment of grace that the Supreme Court has shown, because their practice over the last decade plus has been one of denying access to the right to vote, diminishing the protections that the most vulnerable need. And unfortunately, with the addition of Brett Kavanaugh, who did not agree with the decision yesterday, we know that we are on the side of loss, that again and again, they will continue to erode access to the right to vote. I will grant one thing, that in the Wisconsin decision that did force voters to go to the polls, they did at least acknowledge that perhaps the slow running of the mail should allow people to return their absentee ballots a little bit later. But even that was so small as to not really change the nature of what happened to those voters in that state.
Obviously, we're in a moment of great upheaval and great protest, with people of all stripes saying something's got to give, something's got to change. What would you say to those people? This is one of those kinds of issues that people care about. as you talk about it, it can feel too big, like something you can't fix. But obviously, it's got to be fixed, and it begins with each of us. What would you say?
So the reason I wrote and structured Our Time Is Now the way I did was I began with laying out what the problem is. Because if we don't understand the scope and scale of the challenge, we are not going to be prepared to defeat it. But the second half of the book is about the playbook, how we fight back, how we win, what we can do. And that's why I spend so much time talking about the census, but also talking about how we can fix these voting laws. The reality is these things don't have to be permanent. If we had a permanent state of affairs with elections, then still only 6% of Americans would be eligible to execute their right to vote. But over time, we have expanded who has access to the franchise, and we have fixed what is broken, but we can only fix it when we know what it is. What happened with the Blaylock decision yesterday is that the courts recognized that identity matters, that the identity of being LGBTQ, that the identity of having gender identity or gender expression or sexual orientation, that is all encompassed under our notions of what sex is. And because that identity mattered, because voting matters, because politics matter, we saw progress. I'm hopeful because I know we can make it happen, but it doesn't occur overnight. And what I want young people especially to understand about this moment is that voting is tedious. Mm-hmm. It is a complex process. It is not an instant solution. And anyone who tells you just go vote is being disingenuous at best. It is hard to make change. But the reality is, in a democracy, the only guaranteed possible way to start that change is through your vote. Because when we vote, we select the people who make the decisions. So often we consider systems to be these disembodied, architectures that just issue rules. No, it's people. We elect the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. Senate has to approve the appointment of Supreme Court justices. Those Supreme Court justices who did good with the Blaylock decision, but who did evil with the Shelby decision. The same people in our home state, down in Brunswick, Georgia, the district attorney who refused to prosecute two men who murdered a man in plain sight, who killed Ahmaud Arbery with absolutely no compunction. We get to hire who that person is. We get to hire the district attorney, but we also get to hire the state legislators who should be held responsible for not only passing a hate crimes bill, but also removing the citizen arrest laws that gave those men the sense of impunity that they could kill him and get away with it. We have to take responsibility because we vote in the mayors who appoint the police chiefs who decide what practices and behaviors are permissible in their police departments. It is a hard thing to connect the dots, and it is a tedious thing that feels almost impossible, but it is the only thing that we have that every citizen is guaranteed. And that vote matters because when we use it, when we link it together, change occurs.
It's interesting to me that you put it that way because I feel as though I hear so few people in public life put it that way, that voting is made to sound like pixie dust, like magic, that you just walk in that booth and bang, the world is different, that it is not the long game that it truly is.
Yeah. It's not only a long game, but there's no magical savior. President Barack Obama, while a good man and a great president, was not going to fix America unless we also paid attention to the legislative initiatives that passed in 2010 and 2011 when so many people who wanted him to succeed did not show up and vote in midterm elections. It is never going to be true that a single vote or a single person is our salvation. Our responsibility, especially those in public life, we have to stop lying about how hard this is. It's like a disease. Injustice is a disease. Racism is a disease. Inequity is a disease. And there is no magic pill, despite what Donald Trump might tell us about Clorox and UV light, there is no magic to solving these problems. And the reality is, if we do not apply the treatment daily and weekly of not only voting, but holding leaders accountable, then the evil metastasizes. And then you've got a lot more to have to deal with. Because what we accomplished, for those of us who sit on the side of the progressives, what we accomplished in 2008 was undone because we thought that the medicine had cured us and we didn't show up in 2010. And what happened in 2010 was a decade of metastasization where we lost access to reproductive health, We lost access to criminal justice reform. We lost access and advancement on environmental action. So many of the things that were in the crosshairs of being better became worse because we thought one vote in 2008 was going to solve America. And that's not how it works.
Let's talk a little bit more broadly about this year, this presidential year, and how people look at the race. You hear a lot about swing voters. And as I was reading about you and various things, what I found interesting is your campaign manager, or the woman who was your campaign manager, saying we need to move away from that. We need to look at a more multiracial, multi-platform way of looking at voters rather than just going after this handful of people. And I wanted you to talk about that a little bit because everybody seems to think it comes down to those four people over there where we're going.
So one of the other things I try to be comprehensive in our time is now, because if we think about it, each of these moments, each of these issues become part of how we build the blocks of change. Swing voters have become this very safe conversation to have, because if you only focus on the same group of people with the same profile, then you never have to take responsibility either for success. You never have to take responsibility for failure, and you can take credit for success. But swing voters are this very narrow notion of a set of voters, typically a white voter, whose profile reminds us of the last time we had some sea change. And so right now it is a middle class, middle-aged white voter. Sometimes it's a white woman if you look at the suburbs, sometimes it's a working man in the Midwest, but always it's someone whose political leanings and political values swing, meaning that sometimes they agree with you, sometimes they don't. But the reality is most often they behave exactly the same way, but once in a while they blip on the other side and we're like, oh my God, it's magic. No, it may be that something different happened and that's why they chose this person versus that person. But when we do so, when we focus so exclusively on swing voters, we do so to the exclusion of people who've already said, I agree with you. I share your values. I want what you offer, but you never tell me what you're going to do. You never talk to me. Because when candidates run on swing voter narratives, they intentionally exclude everyone else. And everyone hears your campaign. So if you are a community that has a certain set of values, a certain set of needs, but you never hear your issues spoken about, you never see yourself reflected in the campaign literature. The candidate doesn't bother to come to where you are. Your mail never changes. There's no one calling your phone. You don't get robocalls. You don't have to complain because they ignore your existence. Why would you risk your time? Why would you risk being in line for 4 hours to cast a vote for someone who said, I don't care about you, by their omission of you in their narrative? What we did in Georgia in 2018, what we saw happen across the country, is not magic. We expanded the electorate. We said, we're going to talk to you because you're an American, because you have the right to vote. And more importantly, we're not going to change what we say because we think if we pretend to be something else, you'll vote for us. I don't want anyone to vote for me because I've misrepresented who I am. If you vote for me, it's because you trust what I say and you believe in what I can accomplish. And if you don't vote for me, it's going to be because you heard me and you decided you didn't like me. So I campaigned where they filmed Deliverance. I campaigned where you were born. I campaigned at one music fest and at a gun show. But no, I had the same conversation about gun reform in all of those places. And if we as public officials, as those who stand for office, as Democrats in particular, are willing to acknowledge that identity is real, and all it is I see you and I understand the obstacles and barriers to you having what we hold out as the American dream, and I'm willing to work with you to get there, and I'm willing to invest in you in my campaign to show you I believe, that's how we get more people to vote. And I think that's the pathway we have to follow.
It's interesting you say that, because that sensibility, and I got that feeling for years as I would go out into crowds, that people felt as though people only show up once every 4 years. I'll never see you again. You're never going to do anything. I was watching the Dave Chappelle special that he just did on George Floyd. And he said, you know, everybody lies to us. And you know, I'm going to tell you the truth. And I thought that it was interesting that he was making that point. The whole crowd started to nod. This idea that every institution that you're getting the little bit that somebody thinks that you want to hear, and you're getting that little bit that somebody else wants to hear, and nobody ever hears the full story.
And that's one of the reasons, both in my campaign for governor, but also in the work I do today. When I ran for office the first time, I ran in 2006, and I wasn't from my neighborhood. And in Georgia, around the country, being from a place matters. And I was running for a state legislative seat. One opponent had represented the district for more than a decade. The other person was born down the street from where I lived, and I'd been here 2 years. And so instead of pretending to be of this pace, what I did was like, I don't know all of you, but I know how to do this job. And my candor and honesty was very effective. People believed me when I said, this is what I can do and this is what I can't do. And unfortunately, our politics tend to encourage this notion of fast solutions and this idea that we all can have it if we just try hard enough. We win elections, we win progress when we admit how hard it is and how setbacks happen, and that these things aren't instantaneous, and that we're gonna make mistakes, that I'm gonna flub something, I'm gonna do something I shouldn't do, I'm going to ruin something that you thought was good, I'm gonna make a choice that you're not gonna like, but my responsibility is to tell you why I did it, ask your forgiveness if I was wrong, ask your patience if it's gonna take a while, but never fail to tell you the truth. And whether it's running for an office or it's trying to talk to demonstrators about how we get the reforms we need to save the lives of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and Tony McDade and Rayshard Brooks and all of those names that have become so long we can't remember anymore. It begins with being honest about what happened so that we can be honest about what needs to come next.
A lot has been made of your personal charisma. You're the first African-American woman to be nominated by a major party to run for governor. And then beyond that, you did not, well, correction, you won that race, but you didn't, technically. But as you go into crowds, the connection that people have with you, the excitement that people have with you, there's a lot of conversation of people trying to break it down. What's interesting to me is that we're used to it being, it's somebody's persona. It's that they clap them on the back and I'd love to have a beer with them. You make people do the work. You make people understand the facts and figures. You make them think about it, which everybody would tell you is the opposite of what it takes to capture the public imagination. What do you think it tells us that your place on the scene is dominated by people being willing to read the book, think about the numbers, do the homework, the opposite of everything that we've been told?
I grew up in a community in Mississippi where my parents were super voters. They voted in every election. They were volunteers. They did the civic work you were supposed to do. And yet we lived on the edge of poverty. Sometimes we slipped over that edge and had to claw our way back to just being, you know, working poor. But they never relinquished their obligation to be voters. But I also don't remember a single politician ever coming to our door. And when my parents would take us out to volunteer, we would do the work because it was what we were supposed to do, even though we would say, you know, we're poor too. Mom and dad would say, you know, having nothing is not an excuse for doing nothing. Mm-hmm. But what I always took from that, when we would ask them questions, my parents were honest. They respected us enough to say, this is what is. This is why we tell you to do these things. I mean, my parents are ministers who told me, and my siblings, there's six of us, they said, we're not taking you to heaven with us. You need to learn it for yourself. Now, they took us to church, but they said, we're not taking you to heaven. And, you know, that's a bit jarring to hear when you're 12. But the reason that resonated for me is that they respected us. I respect voters. I respect Americans. I respect people in our country and around the world. And respect means that you treat people like they've got some sense. They may not have all the information you have. They may not have all the access you have, but they deserve to know what you know, and they deserve to know what you intend to do. And so I think sometimes the connection is, I don't pretend that there's something else happening. I don't pretend that I have these solutions that are just going to easily transform the world or even your tax issues. But I'm going to make sure you understand what I can do and what I need you to do to help me do more. Because the other side of the coin is when people just become inured to, well, it's just too hard and I can't do it. And even though I'm in office and I've been here for years, it's just too high a hill to climb and it's not going to happen. I remember this group of elderly, basically grandmothers and grandfathers, who came to my office when I was a Democratic leader. And they had been around that Capitol for years, trying to get someone to pay attention to the fact that they were raising grandchildren, sometimes infants and four-year-olds and seven-year-olds. They couldn't enroll them in school. They couldn't get access to the same funding that they would have gotten if they'd let those kids go into foster care. And because they tried to keep these children in a family, because they tried to take care of them, they were denied the very resources that would make it so. And I remember when they came and sat in there with me and they told me about all the people they talked to and the things they needed, I knew that my obligation wasn't to promise them I could get it done, but they needed to know I would try. But I told them, I'm going to do my best, but I can't get this done without you. You're going to have to do some of this work. I'll open the doors, but I can't tell your story for you. What we see the demonstrators doing today is they're telling their story. And the role that leaders have, the role that people like myself have, is that we've got to open the door. We've got to make sure they've got the microphone. And then we've got to get out of the way to let them tell their story. But then we've got to get to work to pull the policies together to make the solutions possible. We were able to pass a law in Georgia that allowed those children to be enrolled in school for the first time, to have not only enrollment, but to be able to go on field trips, something so many of us take for granted. These kids were denied in the most vulnerable parts of their lives, where resilience was so important. They were told, you're not allowed to be a part of anything bigger. And we were able to get that, but I didn't do it. Those grandparents did it. I just opened the door, and that's what I try to embody, that I'm a mechanism, I'm a cog. I may be a little bit bigger in the process than some are, but I'm never bigger than they are, and I'm never bigger than the processes.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about taking risk. You took a risk, and I'm sure you were told multiple times over by saying, I'd love to be the vice president. Everybody else is out there is pulling punches. I'm telling you, I'd be good at it. I'd be good for you. Let's do this. But there had to be a moment where you had to sit with yourself to say, am I going to do it my way or do it the way I'm being told you're supposed to do it? And why you decided to take the risk? And how will you feel on the other side if somebody says you might have gotten it if you hadn't asked for it?
So I want to reframe what happened. But to answer the question directly, look, in March of 2019, I was meeting with all of the candidates running for president. And one of the candidates was this gentleman named Joe Biden. He invited me to lunch. Within a few days of our lunch, there were stories being written about how we had the secret pact for me to run as his vice president. I ignored the stories for a while, and then finally they were taking over every conversation I was having. And so I answered and said, you do not run for second place in a primary, meaning that I don't think it's appropriate for, at least in the context of that primary, particularly given how diverse the slate was, that it would not be an appropriate thing. But people forgot there was a comma in my sentence. And then I said, but I'd be open to the job once there's a nominee. I've given the exact same answer since March of 2019. Without exception, I have always given that answer. The difference is, the closer we got to that possibly being a reality, the more people assumed that I would suddenly play coy and pretend that I'd never said it before. But that goes back to your earlier question. I was raised to be honest. I was raised to tell the truth. And sometimes the truth is it's none of your business, and so I don't answer the question, but I'm never going to lie.
Yeah.
And the second part was that I started getting a question no one else was getting, which is, are you qualified? I'm a Black woman from Mississippi who came of age in Georgia. And I know that the expectations of me are different. Not only the expectations of what I'm capable of, but the lack of confidence in what I can do. And so when I'm asked the question, are you qualified? I've got to be honest in my answer and I've got to be direct. And the reality is there are some jobs. If someone said, are you qualified for that job? I am not qualified to be a fireman. That's not something I can do right now. I am not qualified to take over, you know, the space station. Can't do it. But am I qualified to serve as the chief lieutenant to the president of the United States based on my long history of legislative accomplishment, my ability to work across the aisle, my very strong, deep capacity to understand policy, to navigate challenges, and the fact that I've run not only multi-state nonprofit organizations and corporations, but I have the executive and the legislative experience to do this work, then my responsibility is to say yes, because I don't just answer for myself. The risk I would be taking if I demurred, if I was coy, I would be taking the risk that not only would I be underestimated, but so would anyone else who looked like me. I would be giving people permission to diminish who I am and what anybody who looks like me can do, because that's one of the things that happens in our society. We impute to women of color, to women writ large, to people of color, we become avatars for our entire community. And so in this space, I don't have the luxury and I don't have the right to not answer. And so the risk for me, it was a risk of silence, because silence is commission. Silence says it's okay to underestimate me. Silence says it's okay to question if I can do something I know I can based simply on what you think you know of me. And so for me, it's not taking a risk. Now, look, if I had been able to anticipate that people weren't going to read all of the things that they'd written before and that the press was going to suddenly create a narrative that fit their line, I can't do anything about it. And maybe I could have been more explicit when I was getting the question 4 weeks ago to say that I know that Joe Biden's going to pick who he picks. But all I could do is meet the moment and answer the questions the way I know to answer them, because that's who I am and that's what I have to do.
Knowing what you know so deeply, do you look at November and find yourself hopeful, find yourself scared? How do you describe your feelings right now?
I will go back to my earlier answer, which is yes.
These are adjectives I want to throw at you.
We are at an inflection point in our nation. Demographically, we're in a space we have never inhabited before, where more than half of the children under the age of 15 are children of color. By 2045, we're going to be a nation that is majority minority for the first time in our history. We're also a nation that is facing unprecedented challenges in terms of the environment, in terms of our internal organization and operation. And because of our current leader, we're also a nation that faces this, unfortunately, familiar space that we occupied when the Know Nothing Party tried to run the country, which is that we have weakened ourselves abroad in ways that are deeply problematic, particularly in a moment of such entrenched globalization. We have so much facing us. COVID-19 can become COVID-2021. We don't know what's going to happen. And so I believe that we have the people in our nation who want to see progress, who want to see inclusion, who want to see justice. I believe that if they will speak, change will come. But I also know that the Republican National Committee, for the first time since 1981, has the financial and the legal authority to invest in voter intimidation. And they've said they plan to do so. They don't call it intimidation, they call it ballot security. But every time they've secured the ballots by trying to scare Black and brown people out of voting, and the organizations they're aligned with have taken legal and they've taken steps to try to impede the ability of others to vote, going so far as to try to deny the opportunity to vote by mail in the midst of a pandemic where physical contact can kill you. So in that space, I have trepidation, but I have faith in America. I have faith in our people. And if we can make certain that our elections have the parameters of support that the Heroes Act can provide, if we make sure that our people know their rights and understand what voter suppression looks like, if we fill out the census and treat that as one of the most important things we can do in our lifetimes, because it is, then I have faith that we can make progress. But I also know that if it all falls apart, we're still America. And while it will be harder to dig out of the rubble of the destruction of another 4 years of Donald Trump, it doesn't mean that it's impossible, but I'd rather not have to try.
I'm going to ask one final one before we go to the viewers. You know, you've run a campaign, so you know what it is to not just try to speak for yourself, but to deal with what somebody else is saying about you. And I think we're starting to get the sense of how this will shape up as we go into the fall, that the Democratic side will be depicted as the party of lawlessness, the far left, anti-police, socialist, you know, big words thrown on that side. How do you redefine yourself? How do you say, whoa, 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 and come back at that? If Joe Biden was taking your advice on what to say back, what would you tell him to do?
I would tell them that our mission isn't to convince those who despise us that they love us. Our job is to convince those who want to love us that they can. And that means that we have to state clearly and plainly who we are and what we want. And this is what's true of the Democratic Party. We want progress. Because let's think about what it means to be a conservative. The very nature of that language says you want to stay where you are, you want to keep what you have, and you don't want change. Well, that means that too many of our American brothers and sisters are left out of justice. Too many are left out of opportunity. Too many are going to be ravaged by COVID-19 and see no relief. We know that we have criminal justice challenges, both on the policing side, but also on the justice side. What happens when you go in? What happens when you come out? We know that our nation is part of a national and part of an international challenge where globalization and climate action are creating new pressures we've never seen. I'm going to talk about, no matter whether I'm on a ticket or not, I'm going to talk about why progress is important. I'm going to talk about why progress is how people get what they need. Progress is how we reduce the need for law enforcement and increase the safety of our communities. I'm going to talk about both reformation of policing and transformation of our public investments. And I'm going to talk about them from a position of who I am. I happen to be a capitalist who likes making money, but also understands that capitalism has to be compassionate, has to be fair, and has to be regulated. But I'm not going to dismiss those who have different values than my own. I'm not going to dismiss those who have different faith traditions than my own. I was raised that my privilege, such and small as it is, even when I stand in a space like being someone who can write a book and get people to talk to me, my job is to be a shield for others, never a sword. And if we have that conversation with America, if Democrats stand in our truth and we share our values, which may be wide ranging, but are always on the side of progress, then I have no doubt that we can be successful.
I'm looking at some of the questions, and one person asked, couldn't we use technology to vote if we can do online banking and that's safe and possible? Could the banks help with the voting? Could that be an option that everybody could just sit at their kitchen table and do it?
Not yet. One, because the U.S. Senate under Mitch McConnell has refused to address the challenges that actually would impede our ability to vote. Banking, online banking has laws that are international laws, both national laws and federal laws and international laws that actually put constraints on who can break in, what they can do, and what the consequences are. We don't have those protections for voting. And so you'd have to have a U.S. Senate willing to do that. But we also have to recognize that not everyone has access to a bank. We know that millions of Americans who receive food stamps could not get their COVID checks, their stimulus checks, because they don't get banked. And too many Americans have no access to banking. And so part of the responsibility of election reform is making that reformation applicable to every voter, not only those who have the ability to use technology, but those for whom analog will be the only way they ever have participation and ever have access to the next.
Another question, somebody watched you on The Daily Show and they enjoyed it. And they said, you started talking about people coming to polling stations and making it difficult for people to vote. What can we do to combat these individuals? Are there plans to organize groups to work on vote day so that it doesn't happen?
Yes. So in the wake of the 2018 election, because I had plenty of time on my hands, I created three organizations. So I had to become governor. I could have been doing something else. But in lieu thereof, I started Fair Fight, which focuses on voter protection, Fair Count, which focuses on the census, and the Southern Economic Advancement Project, which focuses on economic justice in the South. Fair Fight has been working since 2019 to build up voter protection teams in our battleground states, which are the states where we know the Republicans are going to target their fire and target their voter intimidation. We have done deep research on what they're trying to do, and we are recruiting volunteers, recruiting poll observers, trying to get people of goodwill to come together to help. But we also have to be prepared for litigation, and we've got to be prepared for the fact that the laws may not stop them from doing what they want, which is why we also have to make certain that as many people can vote from home as would like to, that we have the opening of polling places in communities so people don't have to travel to distant and unfortunately unfamiliar areas where they can be targeted. That's why we have to think about the entire ecosystem of voting and not simply one solution. But yes, if you want to help, we want you to go to fairfight2020.com, sign up, and we'd love to have your help.
Somebody from the county I live in, Montgomery County, talks about the troubles they had here when we had the primary. And they said, there's now legislation in Harrisburg to automatically send ballots to every registered voter. How do we get every state to do the same? The Republicans insist it's ripe for fraud, and yet they sent an application to every Republican in Pennsylvania for the primary. I'm an elected official in my municipality, and I really want to have some answers here. What do you say to them?
So the only solution is the HEROES Act. That's what Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, passed a few weeks ago. It puts into place $3.6 billion, which is what the Brennan Center has said is necessary to sufficiently scale up voting in every state, including making sure that every state has access to mail-in ballots. Now, let's be clear. 34 states already permit no excuses vote by mail, like Maryland. You can vote by mail no matter what, but you have to be able to get the ballot, get the application, get the ballot, go through the process. We've got 16 states that require an excuse. And in a state like Alabama, the only excuses they permit, either you're 65, you're disabled, or you face some type of terminal illness. And I'm getting the language not completely accurate, but it's fairly narrow. And the reality is that there are a number of states, 16 states, that have made it harder. What the HEROES Act will say is that every state has to provide access to mail-in ballot applications. Every state has to then provide those ballots, and it gives them the resources to scale up that process. What happened in Maryland, what happened in Pennsylvania, what happened in Nevada, what happened in Georgia, is that it's not just having the right, it's having the resources to scale it to meet the moment. We had an extraordinary number of people who wanted to vote by mail because of COVID, and unfortunately, the Secretary of State, who knew that we were going to have an unusual number of people who tried to use it, in part because we worked with him to send out applications to 6.9 million voters, was that he did not invest the necessary resources to allow those applications to be processed and for people to get their ballots. And so the solution is a federal solution, because our counties, our states are cash strapped. The same challenges that we saw happen to businesses, those businesses aren't paying their taxes. People who aren't working aren't paying income taxes. Mm-hmm. We are watching budgets collapse across this country, and that's going to require federal investment. But it's why we have a federal government. Our compact, as states said, that the federal government will step in and help us all. We saw them do it with the Paycheck Protection Act. We saw it with the COVID stimulus package. We need to see it in dollars sent to our states to ensure and secure our elections.
Someone asked, I'm an organizer working with people across the country, including in Georgia. Can you talk a little bit about your view of organizing in relationships to voting and elections? How much impact do you think we can have with all that we're up against?
When I was growing up, when my parents would take us to volunteer, I used to be a little annoyed because, as I think I asked once, how two Black people and their six kids going to fix Mississippi? And my parents said, I'm like, shouldn't there be someone bigger doing this? And they said, that's called government, but sometimes government doesn't do what it should. And so we step in and we do what we can. Organizing is about doing what we can. We can never organize our way out of the challenges we have by thinking organizing alone will do the job, but organizing is a critical piece of it. Long before I stood for public office, I was a protester who led protests during the Rodney King demonstrations in Atlanta after that decision. I did some other things, including expressing my displeasure about the Confederate battle flag. I did a lot of stuff on that side, and it worked, because it's not that we have to change the world in a day, but we've got to change how people see themselves in the world. And that's what organizing does. Organizing gives people the tools to describe what they feel, and it gives them the ability to do something about it. And that incremental organizing isn't separate from the other work that has to be done. It is an instrumental part of it. And the more we do it, especially from different vantage points, when people keep hearing that this is a way to solve their problems, they'll start to believe. And so I encourage organizing across the spectrum, because when we organize, we give people the capacity to know what they can ask for, and more importantly, what they deserve to demand.
Somebody says, what would you say to young people, perhaps first or second time voters who are politically motivated and have seen the destruction of the Trump administration to our country, but are unenthused by Joe Biden? How can we look them in the eye and tell them to vote for somebody they don't believe in just because they may be the best hope?
I've heard the lesser of two evils, the lack of enthusiasm conversation since the time immemorial, since I got here. But I will tell, I mean, actually, the only fight I've ever gotten into in school, not with my siblings, was a fight I had when I was in second grade about the 1980 election. So, you know, I say this honestly. I've been thinking about this for a very long time. But here's the thing. Not being enthusiastic about the standard bearer does not mean you can't be enthusiastic about the change. Donald Trump is an incompetent coward who has broken our country. He is a wannabe authoritarian populist who threatened to militarize something. I'm trying to say this in a way that is, because I don't want people to dismiss it because I'm angry, but I want you to hear the anger that I feel. This is a man who, standing in the most powerful place, arguably in the world, decided to respond to the murders and the extrajudicial killings by saying that he wants to create a database that will be optional for some as his response to these murders. We saw him cage children. We saw him in the midst of Pride Month. We saw him strip away protections for the LGBTQ community in housing and in healthcare. He was going to hold a rally at the site of the Tulsa massacre of Black people on Juneteenth. He does not care. And what that should signal is this: Joe Biden may not be the perfect solution, but he is an answer. And he's an answer who has shown himself willing to take accountability, willing to show courage, willing to listen, willing to serve, and willing to do what it takes to help restore our country. You don't have to be in love with him, but you can be in deep like with what he promises, because the consequences of an action are not simply that you didn't have a responsibility for what happened. You are participating in the continuation of destruction. And I don't believe in getting people to vote by saying, well, if you don't vote, you're causing, you know, you're going to be at fault. But I do believe in being honest and saying that inaction is its own decision. And every vote that does not go to Joe Biden in our system is a vote that goes to Donald Trump, because we do not have a system that allows third parties to have meaningful effect. And so if you are not supporting Joe Biden, then you are supporting the absence of his help, and you are thus supporting Donald Trump. And let's remember, 78,000 people decided the outcome of the 2016 election, but 6 million people stayed home. 78,000 versus 6 million. Please, God, be part of the 6 million who are going to show up this time so we can save our country.
What do you think are the top three issues facing America that the next president needs to tackle immediately? And if you were the Veep, what would your agenda look like?
So first of all, Veep does not have an agenda. The job of the vice president is to do what the president directs. But I would, if asked to advise, here are the three things I would, here's the primacy I would give them. Number one, democracy. We need to pass H.R. 1 and H.R. 4, which are the two bills that actually allow more Americans to participate in the process of democracy. And included in H.R. 1 is not only same-day registration, online registration, the solution to a number of the ills that I lay out in the first few chapters of Our Time Is Now about voter suppression, but it also includes making Washington, D.C. a state and making sure that Puerto Rico has self-determination. And if they determine they want to be a state, welcoming them in. That helps correct imbalances that have been built into our system that should not exist, particularly for people of color. So democracy first. Second is that we have to focus on environmental action. This is a threat not simply to the long-term issue of our nation's health, our world health, but it has very direct implications for the poor. I live in a state that gets ravaged by hurricanes. I grew up in a state where that happened. And the ability for communities of color, for poor communities to be resilient to the ravages of climate change is diminishing every single year, every single cycle. When they lose their jobs, when they lose their homes, these things don't come back. And poverty gets a deeper hold. So we have to take action on climate. And third, we have to take action on our economy. We have an economy that does not work for Americans. When you can work a full-time job and you can't have access to healthcare, you can't afford to pay for housing, you can't afford to pay for daycare, you can't take care of your family, then your wages are not livable. And we have to have a process and the ability to declare that in this country, we're going to fix our economy so that when you work as part of your side of the bargain, you will make the money you need to take care of yourself and your family on our side of the bargain. That would be perfect.
And finally, I love this one. I think it's a good one to end on. Wouldn't we all be better with you on the U.S. Supreme Court than as a Democratic VP?
I have no interest in being a judge. My younger sister, Leslie, is the first Black woman to be a federal judge in the history of the state of Georgia. Leslie has been interested in being a judge since she and I read, I can't remember how it happened, but she read a bio of Thurgood Marshall when she was 8. I had to listen to her tell me about him, even though I knew about him before, over and over again. Leslie's temperament is the judicial temperament. She understands the law. She understands how it should work. And she understands how justice should work. I believe in policy. I believe that we have to construct the world we want to see, both here and abroad. I believe that we have to do the work of actually changing minds and changing laws, that we cannot allow the systems that exist to remain in perpetuity because we have ignored our responsibility to build different systems. I was kindly referred to as a systems thinker by someone once, and that's how I approach the world. That's why I didn't want to go to the Senate, because the Senate, while a very important and valuable part of our democracy, is not what draws me. I'm drawn to the ability to execute, to imagine, to build, and to execute, and I want to keep doing that work. And the reality is, whether I do it in office or out of office, if you look at my trajectory, if you look at my history, the title doesn't matter. I'm going to find a way to do the work. And I do that because, as I'd like to say, our time is now.
Well done. Bringing it back to the book. Expertly done. Thank you for spending this time with us. I think there was so much to think on, so much for people to work on. And that's what it's about, as you pointed out. It's about doing the work. So thank you and be well. And it will be an interesting time between now and November. And I know we'll see a lot of you.
Well, Tamala, thank you so much for being such a gracious host. Thank you to the Philadelphia Free Library for having me. And thank you all for indulging me and picking up the book, but more importantly, for doing the work, because we can win. And I know it can happen. So thank you.
All right. Have a beautiful night.
You too. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.